Okay, let's pick up where we left off in the book of Hosea. We left off in chapter 8. Okay, let's just jump right into it since we're running so late. It says in verse 1, "Put the trumpet to your lips like an eagle. The enemy comes against the house of the Lord, because they have transgressed my covenant and rebelled against my law. They cry out to me, 'My God, we of Israel know thee.' Israel has rejected the good. The enemy will pursue him. They have set up kings, but not by me. They have appointed princesses, but I did not know it. With their silver and their gold they have made idols for themselves, that they might be cut off. He has rejected your calf, O Samaria, saying, 'My anger burns against them. How long will they be incapable of innocence?'" Back up to the first verse. Again, Hosea is continuing this theme of judgment that's about to become, and this is just about to fall on, you know, the northern tribes of Israel in particular, because of their waywardness. And when Hosea wrote this, it was just a matter of years before it was all fulfilled. I mean, they were right at the very, very brink of their destruction, of their exile, of their punishment. And verse 1 in chapter 8, I think, puts a timetable right there, because it says, "Put the trumpet to your lips like an eagle. The enemy comes against the house of the Lord, because they have transgressed my covenant and rebelled against my law." When it says, "Put the trumpet to your lips," this is what the watchmen would do. You know, on a city, they would have the watchtowers. The watchman's responsibility was to constantly survey the landscape, and if they saw an enemy coming, their job was to, you know, blow the trumpet and warn all the people who were out in the fields and out in the pasture lands and out there outside the city that it was an alarm, to drop everything you're doing, run for your lives, get into the city, close the door for protection, because an enemy was coming. So when I say put the trumpet to your lips, it's like, hey man, the enemy is on its way. I mean, it's already set in motion. He says, "Like an eagle, the enemy comes against the house of the Lord." And when Assyria did come down upon the northern tribes of Israel, they just swooped down, you know, with lightning speed. And they just overran the northern tribes and just created utter devastation upon the cities and the villages and the towns and the people. And they showed absolutely no mercy. I mean, the Assyrians were absolutely brutal. I mean, they had no qualms about ripping open pregnant women, about dismembering people, decapitating people, skinning people alive. I mean, it was really horrendous. These people had absolutely no tinge of compassion whatsoever. They were very, very cruel. And, you know, it's God who was the protector of Israel, but they had turned their back on him and they rejected him. So it was just a matter of time before this punishment fell right on their heads. Because it says very plainly in that verse, that latter part of verse 1, "Because they have transgressed my covenant and rebelled against my law." That's the only reason why it happened. Had they been faithful to God, there's no enemy in the world that could have touched them. There's just no way. Because he was their protection. And the Bible makes it abundantly clear that unless the Lord protects the house, what good is it? Unless the Lord protects the city, the watchman doesn't do a bit of good. Mm-hmm. You know, unless the Lord protects the home, all the safety procedures you have, all the safety locks or things that you may have to try to defend yourself, they're all useless unless God is behind in your protection. And in verse 2 it says, "They cry to me, 'My God, we of Israel know thee.'" Now, does that sound like America to you? Mm-hmm. Okay. I've said poll after poll after poll shows that 95-96% of the people in this country claim to believe in God, and about 90% of them claim to be Christian. Okay? But my gosh, isn't it abundantly clear that it's only lip service? It's only lip service. Because I'm telling you right now, if every person in this country who claim to be Christian, who claim to believe in Jesus Christ, if they were totally committed to him, do you think that we would be in this mess right now?
No.
We wouldn't. There's no way. There's no way. It would be impossible that we would be in such a sad shape that we're in. But the thing is, people only use God for their own convenience. You know, they're not going to follow him. They're not going to obey him. But they like to just, you know, acknowledge him, because it gives them, like I said, a false sense of security. And that's exactly what this country does. Let's just say that everybody who professed to be Christian were to turn off all the smut, all the pornography, all the garbage on TV, you know, and refuse to go to the cinema that is showing films that are just really offensive to God. What I'm saying is this: it's obvious that if everybody who claimed that were all of a sudden, you know, make this commitment in their life. Man, we could turn this nation on its ear overnight. But you see, we only profess to believe in God with our lips. But in our hearts, we've set up idols. We're our own God. We're going to do what we want to do. I mean, God is just simply there as a convenience. You know, somebody to say, well, we know him. That's what they say here. It says here, they cry to me, my God, we of Israel know thee. Or you could say, my God, we of America know thee. Well, obviously, the only thing they know about God is some head acknowledgement. Well, God exists. And that's about it, because it's certainly not an intimate relationship that's defined by obedience and commitment. Then he says here in that verse 3, Israel has rejected the good, the enemy will pursue him. Has America rejected the good?
Yes.
I mean, it was just outright rejected it. When a country or a person or a nation or a society, when they reject the good, they're just not going to live in a vacuum. They're going to embrace the bad, the evil. Look at this. I mean, look at the decisions that are being made by the Supreme Court. I mean, where they can say that, you know, virtual child porn is a First Amendment right, that they have the right to watch child pornography. And this only inflames certain individuals in our society to commit all these sins. But I'm telling you right now, it's the ones who have legalized this kind of thing that inflames these, you know, perverted individuals who are really responsible for this. Well, all I'm saying is, hey, all we have to do is look around and we can see, well, we have rejected the good. Well, we throw our God out of our schools, that's rejecting the good. We throw him out of our courts, that's rejecting the good. We throw him out, and in many places, people haven't thrown God out of their houses, but they very politely asked him to leave. So what happens? Once God's gone, there's a vacuum there. Believe me, the devil's going to fill in an instant. In verse 4, it says, they have also set up kings, but not by me. They have appointed princesses, but I did not know it. They set up, you know, you can apply this to the United States. It says, they have set up presidents, but not by me. And they have appointed politicians, but I did not know it. With their silver and the gold, they have made idols of themselves, that they might be cut off. In other words, I think it's very, very, very important that a Christian takes his civic duties, responsibilities, he takes it serious. When you got a situation where this last election, the turnout was way low, and the number of professing Christians who didn't even vote, I mean, were in the tens of millions. Well, what does this say? When people do not go and vote at the polls for, if nothing else, the lesser of two evils, if you can't find a good man, well, then pick the lesser of the two evils if you have to, okay? But people are so apathetic, indifferent, that they don't even do that. They're going to have to account to God for that, because the more apathetic people become, the more they don't exercise this right, the more wicked people get in. And it's their fault.
Some are so angry, they go, the poll system's corrupt, I'm just not going to vote anymore.
Now, if you've got a Hitler and you got Stalin running, and that's all you've got, then heck, I wouldn't vote either. Okay?
Yeah.
But if you do have a choice, if there are some moral differences, and you have an obligation to get out there, this is the sad state that we're in. And this is exactly where Israel was at. They appointed kings, not by me. They appointed these politicians, not by me. I didn't know it. And instead, it says, with their silver and the gold, they have made idols for themselves, that they might be cut off. In other words, money is more important to them than anything. When it suggests this, it suggests that they're trying to put politicians in there who are going to somehow make their voters get some kind of monetary benefit from particular people being in office. Let's just read this again, because that's why it's tied together. They have set up kings, but not by me. They have appointed princesses or politicians, but I did not know it. With their silver and their gold, they have made idols of themselves, for themselves, that they might be cut off. Money was more important to people than their souls. It was more important to people, okay, than doing the right thing. That's what this is saying here, that these people were more interested and somehow getting their welfare check or some kind of kickback from the government or some kind of benefit from these people in office, rather than being concerned about their moral character and where they stood with God. It says in verse 5, he has rejected your calf, O Samaria, saying, my anger burns against them. How long will they be incapable of innocence? He rejected their calf. Like in Samaria, they, like I mentioned before, they set up a golden calf. They claimed that it represented the God of heaven. Okay? And it was a place where it was very convenient for them to go to worship rather than down in Jerusalem where they were commanded to go to worship. And of course, once they did that, once they set up this false idol, even though they claimed it was representing the one true God, it was a perversion of the true worship of God. And so it was just inevitable that the pagan practices would be inculcated into their religious ceremonies. And then little incremental steps at a time, they fell into more and more sin and depravity in their worship and their pagan rituals. And he says, how long will they be incapable of innocence? Is that the United States? What happens when people become incapable of innocence? It's like you see a hardened criminal. A hardened criminal is incapable of innocence. Why? Because his life is one never-ending string of doing evil. Be it big or little, small or great, be it one degree or another, they spend a lifetime doing evil to the point where they're incapable of innocence. This nation has become just like that. We are incapable of doing innocence. Why? Because we have become hardened evildoers. He says here in that verse 6, he says, From Israel is even this, a craftsman made it, so it is not God. Surely the calf of Samaria will be broken to pieces. They sow the wind and they reap the whirlwind. The standing grain has no heads, it yields no grain. Should it yield, strangers would swallow it up. Okay, it says in verse 6, for from Israel even this. In other words, it's almost like the way it's worded there. It's almost like from the very people who should know better. What happens? It says that a craftsman made it, so it is not God. He made what? The calf of Samaria. These people should have known better, certainly from their own history, because this is what Aaron did. Remember? Mm-hmm. When he made a golden calf, mm-hmm. and then a number of thousands of people died because of it, and Aaron really got chastised because of it. These people should have known better. I mean, and the United States should know better. When it says here, from Israel even this, or should say, from America even this, a craftsman made it so it's not God, surely the calf of Samaria will be broken to pieces. In other words, what have we set up to be God in this country? One of the things that really gets me is that this whole push for this concept of evolution, okay, that just the whole thing is a lie that's spewed right out of the bowels of hell, and yet people know better. They know this is a bunch of bunk, but they cling to it because in clinging to it, what? They feel like that they no longer have to be accountable to this God. I mean, you look at what Israel did. I mean, these people should have known better, and they turn around, and God says, because you've done this, I'm going to break this idol of yours to pieces. And all the idols that we have set up in our hearts and in this nation, it's all going to go up in smoke. It says here, for they sow the wind and they reap the whirlwind. Now, here's sowing to the wind. I'll give you an example. Back in 1963, under this wicked, wicked, evil woman, Madeline Marie O'Hare, who was a modern-day Jezebel, just hated God with a passion so much that she went to the Supreme Court and got prayer thrown out of school through the compliance of these wicked, evil judges. Threw God out of her school in 1963, right? So that was sowing to the wind. Now, are we reaping the whirlwind when we look at our classes today and look at our schools today, when they've become killing fields, when they've become institutions of ignorance and violence and stupidity? I mean, look at our schools. I mean, it's appalling. It's really appalling that the things that they teach, everything from sex education to self-esteem and all these other things that they place so much importance on, are getting us nowhere. When you turn around and you look at what they don't teach, is they don't know English, they don't know how to read, they don't know how to write. I mean, a million kids a year are graduating who are functionally illiterate. I mean, we've sown to the wind, so we reap the whirlwind. That's just one tiny example. We sow to the wind by taking God out of our courts, we're reaping the whirlwind. You'd be lucky to get a speedy trial that renders justice. The whole thing has become a joke. Why? Because we sow into the wind, we reap the whirlwind. He says the standing grain has no heads, it yields no grain. Should it yield, strangers would swallow it up. Here, God is saying, that one of the judgments that has come upon Israel is economically. Mm-hmm. Even though this country is still the wealthiest country on earth, let's face it, the average Joe Blow is doing what? He's living from paycheck to paycheck. Look what's happening. This state, I mentioned this last week, this state is over $26 billion in debt thanks to this governor. So what are they going to do? They're voting, right? And what's happening? Instead of cutting spending, they're going to increase taxes. They're going to increase our taxes rather than cutting their spending. Well, just read it here. The standing grain has no heads. It yields no grain. People don't have any money to work with. But if they did, should it yield, strangers would swallow it up. They're taking our money. Who are they giving it to? Illegal aliens that are coming into this country. There's no question about it. It's a judgment from Almighty God that how many people can see this? They don't see it. I mean, they don't want to see it. And verse 8 says, Israel is swallowed up. They are now among the nations, like a vessel which is in which no one delights. Are we swallowed up? We're now among the nations? In other words, they were going into exile, but at the same token, what's happening to our nation? We are now among the nations. I mentioned this the other day, that there's over 200 different languages being spoken in L.A. alone. Okay, dozens and dozens of different languages that the school has to deal with. Because people are coming in here, and many of them have no desire to learn English, no desire to become American. It says, Israel swallowed up, they are now among the nations, like a vessel which no one delights. In other words, when the people that do come into this country who are illegal, I mean, it's like, and they don't desire to become American, do they really delight in America and what it stands for? No, they don't delight in it. It's a judgment from God. It says in verse 9, for they have gone up to Assyria like a wild donkey all alone. Ephraim has hired lovers, even though they hire allies among the nations. Now I will gather them up, and they will begin to diminish because of the burden of the king of princes. In other words, what he's saying here is that in this particular period of time, northern Israel was having a problem with Syria. The Syria was right above northern Israel. And Syria was threatening to come down and invade the northern tribes of Israel. Well, instead of Israel looking to God for protection, looking to God for wisdom, guidance, and direction, looking for God to deliver them or to protect them, no, they go to Assyria and they go to Egypt to try to make alliances to defend them against Syria. But what happens? In the end, the very people that they try to align themselves with are the ones that overrun them, stab them in the back, and destroy them. Mm-hmm. This is what happens when we turn away from God and try to turn to other sources to solve our problems. Mm-hmm. They only make things worse. This is what's happening in this country. You can apply it in so many different ways where we don't turn to God. The Bible says abundantly clear, hey, if my people who are called by my name will humble themselves and seek my face and pray and turn from their wicked ways, I will heal their land. That's what it takes. And if we did that, this war on terrorism would be over in a hurry. But who are we looking to God? No, we're looking for all these other stupid, asinine solutions to try to solve this problem. It ain't going to work. And it says here... it says in the latter part of that verse 10, now I will gather them up and they will begin to diminish because of the burden of the king of princes. And I think what it's referring to is because of the burden of the king of princes. The king of princes would have to refer to Christ or God, and the burden would refer to this judgment, because of the judgment of God, if I'm not mistaken. And then it says in verse 11, it says, since Ephraim has multiplied altars for sin, they have become altars of sinning for him. Look at how we have multiplied our altars for sin. Our altars for sin. This boob tube is an altar for sin. It doesn't have to be, but it's become that. The cinema and Hollywood, the entertainment industry, the computer, and the list can go on and on. These have become what? Altars for sin. Rather than for the glory of God. Look, it says here, Ephraim has multiplied altars for sin. They have become altars of sinning for him. Right? I mean, just take the computer. That is a tremendous invention that could be a tremendous blessing. And there's a lot of good in it. As a matter of fact, we're using it now to try to get the word out, right? but it's become an altar for sin, so it's multiplying sin exponentially throughout the world. Just like with it was Israel of old, okay, the more altars they set up, the more sin abounded. Okay, and then it says here in verse 12, it says, though I wrote for him 10,000 precepts of my law, they regarded it as a strange thing. They are regarded as a strange thing. Isn't that interesting? God says this, though I wrote for him 10,000 precepts of my law. Now, I don't think you will find 10,000 precepts in the Bible. You won't. God is using a figure of speech here, like we would use, I told you 1,000 times. It's an expression. Okay, here. What has God said about homosexuality? He has made it abundantly clear through, you know, through Genesis, through Revelation, that this is a wickedness that abounds before God, and he will punish it. But read this. Read it and apply it just to that one sin. It says, though I wrote to him 10,000 precepts of my law, they are regarded as a strange thing. In other words, stand up and say, hey, homosexuality is a sin. It is not an alternate lifestyle. It is a sin before Almighty God, and those who practice such things are under judgment, and AIDS itself is a result of this sin, is a judgment from this sin, and if you don't repent of this sin, you're going to go to hell. Okay, say that. Well, to say that, you're only repeating what God has said. That's, you know, it's not my opinion or anybody else's opinion. You're only repeating what God has made abundantly clear. But say that, and people say, oh, man, that's terrible. This guy is hateful. This guy is bigoted. This guy is homophobic. This guy is a fanatic. This guy is dangerous. And on and on and on and on. Because I can't believe God would really say that.
He probably gets shot.
Oh, yeah, sure. That's where we are headed. And it is scary, isn't it? He says in verse 13, he says, as for my sacrificial gifts, they sacrifice the flesh and eat it, but the Lord has taken no delight in them. Now he will remember their iniquity and punish them for their sins. They will return to Egypt, for Israel has forgotten his maker and built palaces, and Judah has multiplied fortified cities. But I will send fire on its cities that it may consume its palatial dwellings. It says here that even in all their wickedness, they still took pleasure, or they still sacrificed to God. They still prayed to God. They still went through their rituals and their doctrines and their traditions before the God. This is what it's saying here in verse 13. As for my sacrificial gifts, they sacrifice the flesh and eat it, but the Lord has taken no delight in them. In other words, you could just paraphrase that. These people go to church once a week or twice a year, okay, and offer me lip service. I don't take any delight in that because their hearts are far from me and they're not obeying me. The problem with going to church once a week or twice a year without being committed to God, it gives you a false sense of security. The devil loves it. He says, yeah, go to church, man, you big fool. Go to church and make you feel good. They inoculate you with just enough religion to make you feel comfortable in your sins because you feel like, hey, I pray and not me and God are tight. Okay? You've got a much better chance if you're going running away from God than trying to, you know, pray towards the east and walk towards the west. You got a much better chance of being saved if you just flat out turn your back on God rather than constantly doing this jig where you're claiming God on one hand and then denying him with your actions. And so he says, hey, he will remember their iniquity. You know, when I read this, he says, now he will remember their iniquity. To me, that is both comforting and frightening. When I look at all the wickedness in this country, especially by our cultural elite, especially by the lawyers and the politicians and the media moguls and our entertainment industry. Mm-hmm. When I look at these and I think to myself, hey, you know, how much longer are they going to push this envelope? How much longer are they going to keep giving their middle finger to God? And how much longer is he going to ignore them? Well, he remembers it. He will remember their iniquity. He hasn't forgotten. He's just long-suffering. He's patient. You know, he's not like me. If I was him, I'd squash these people like a bug. Not because, you know, I think I'm better than them, but because I couldn't take their constant insults day and night, day and night, day and night. And if I had the power, man, then boom. Thank God he's not like me and he's not like you. But he's long-suffering and patient. But he'll remember. He'll remember the iniquity. And when the day of recompense comes, he will dish out their punishment in full measure. He says here, and punish them for their sins, they will return to Egypt. God told them, when he brought them out of Egypt, that they were never to return to Egypt. But because of their disobedience, now they're going to end up, the survivors are going to be incarcerated around, well, away to Egypt and to Assyria and to all these other different places. And he says in verse 14, "For Israel has forgotten his maker and built palaces." You could put, "And America has forgotten its maker and built what?" We've built all these institutions that have nothing to do with him. Have we forgotten him in our schools? Israel has forgotten its maker and built what? Schools, courts, institutions, businesses, everything, and done what? They utilize these things to offend God. So Judah has multiplied fortified cities, but I will send fire on his cities. In other words, we think that we're secure in this nation. Because why? We got the most powerful military on earth. It's a joke. It's a joke. Look, 9/11 showed us what a joke it is. That's what God is saying here. With all the money that we spend, the trillions and trillions and trillions and trillions of dollars that we spend on quote-unquote national defense, it ain't going to do a hoot for the difference when it's our time to be judged. Okay, we still have 25 minutes, so let's go through this chapter 9 real quick. Beginning with verse 1, it says, "Do not rejoice, O Israel, with exultation like the nation, for you have played the harlot, forsaken your God. You have loved the harlot's earnings and every threshing floor. The threshing floor and the wine press will not feed them, and the new wine will fail them. They will not remain in the Lord's land, but Ephraim will return to Egypt and Assyria, and in Assyria they will eat unclean food." Back up to that first part of this, first verse of this chapter 9. It says, "Do not rejoice, O Israel, with exultation like the nations, for you have played the harlot, forsaken your God. You have loved the harlot's earnings on every threshing floor." What he's saying here, okay, don't rejoice in your power or your military or your might or your money or anything else, because your judgment is certain. And he says here that you have played the harlot, spiritually speaking. Okay, they have turned from God. They've sought out other things. And remember, whatever you put before God, that is harlotry. That is spiritual prostitution, because you are forsaking him and putting something above him. He says, "Forsaking your God, you have loved harlot's earnings on every threshing floor." And what that's saying is, these people, at their harvest period, on their threshing floors, at the end of the harvest, they would have great celebrations because of all the abundant crops or whatever, and they would end up giving Baal the credit. And they would end up worshiping him as well as the God of heaven, but Baal was given credit. And then they would end up debasing themselves through all kinds of pagan rituals and worship ceremonies. So what God is saying here is that he's going to judge them at the very place where they have offended him. And then where is that? Verse 2, "Threshing floors and wine press will not feed them, and the new wine will fail them." In other words, we have, for example, on our dollar bill, "In God We Trust," right? Mm-hmm. The dollar bill is something we put before God as a nation, right? We put money before him. It's very obvious when you can say it's the economy stupid and people will vote for people who are diametrically opposed to everything God stands for simply because we put money before God. Well, this is where God's going to hit us, mm-hmm. where it's really going to hurt in our pocketbook. And we're already hurting. It's a judgment. And then he says here, the new wine will fail them. I mean, you can almost apply it to America. All their new investments is going to go in the toilet. I mean, if we put money before God, material things before God, this is what's going to happen. Verse 3 says, "They will not remain in the Lord's land, but Ephraim will return to Egypt, and in Assyria they will eat unclean food." Well, it was just a matter of time before this all unfolded, and God's people were sent away into these other lands. Now, keep something in mind. God is not no respecter of persons. He told Israel, when they went into the promised land, he said, "You're going to go in there, and I want you to destroy these people, the Canaanites. You are to wipe them out. Men, women, and children, you are to destroy every one of them. Don't let any of them live, because they are so evil, they are so corrupted, that if you let any of them live, they're going to corrupt you." And he warned them. He says, "If you start acting like them, out you go. Out you go." Well, here it happened. They started acting like the pagans, and now God says, you're out. You're out of here. You know, he throws them out of their land. They're going into captivity in Assyria and Egypt. And in verse 4 it says, they will not pour out libations or wine to the Lord. Their sacrifice will not please him. Their bread will be like mourner's bread. All who eat of it will be defiled, for their bread will be for themselves alone. It will not enter the house of the Lord. In other words, they did take great pride in going and offering sacrifices to the Lord, and then they would get part of that animal, or that sacrifice would be given to them for their food. The priest would get a portion, and God would get a portion. Well, they enjoyed those sacrifices. They enjoyed those festivals. They enjoyed that time. But I said, hey, I'm taking all that away from you, because it's all phony. It's like today. We enjoy our holidays like Christmas, right, and our Easter, our Thanksgiving. We completely perverted the true meaning of any of this, because it's all meant for self-gratification rather than the glory for the glory of God. So it says here in that verse 5, it says, what will you do on the day of their appointed festivals and on the day of the feast of the Lord? In other words, when they're in their land of captivity, what are they going to do? They can't offer their sacrifices to God. Okay? And it says here in verse 6, for behold, they will go because of destruction. Egypt will gather them up. Memphis will bury them. Weeds will take over their treasures of silver. Thorns will be in their tents. So it's saying here, once they're overrun, their enemies, Memphis was at that particular time the capital of Egypt, their enemies will end up burying them. Believe me, our enemies are going to end up burying us. It's just a matter of time. And people may laugh at that, but I'm telling you, if this nation isn't any better than any of these other nations that have been buried in the past because of their wickedness. So it says here, Egypt will gather them up, Memphis will bury them, weeds will take over their treasures of silver. Remember what Jesus said in the parable that he gave of the sower and seed? He said that some fell on good on rocky soil, and some fell on the on shallow ground. And he said some fell among thistles and thorns. And what did he say thistles and thorns represented?
Cares and worries of the world.
Cares and the worries of the world and the deceitfulness of riches. In other words, the deceitfulness of riches can choke out a person's spirituality. Okay, if they end up putting money before God. People don't do this. People don't wake up in the morning and say, hey man, money is more important to me than God. Money is just more important to me than God. They don't do that. They don't go to church and say, well, God, you're second place. Money is more important to me than you. Nobody does that. No, everybody, you know, gives God this mental assent. But what's here is what? Their treasure is what? Their money is more important. And so what happens? It chokes out the spiritual life. And so when it says here, the weeds will take over the treasures of silver, thrones will be in their tents. You know, to me, that's very poetic. That all, you know, the most important things in their life are now being overrun by thistles and thorns. Where's the first mention in the Bible of thorns?
Genesis.
When? When the fall happened. Mm-hmm. You know, there was no weeds, there was no thistles, there was no thorns. But after the fall, there was a curse that was brought upon mankind. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, man had to earn his living by the sweat of his brow amongst thistles and thorns. I mean, this was a curse. Well, this curse has overtaken them. And in verse 7 it says, the days of punishment have come, the days of retribution have come. Let Israel know this. The prophet is a fool, the inspired man is demented. Because of the grossness of your iniquity and because of your hostility is so great. Now, reading this one verse in its totality, you could take this two different ways. And each way you take it, I think, is very significant. It says, the days of punishment have come, the days of retribution have come. Let Israel know this. Now it says this, the prophet is a fool, the inspired man is demented. But read the context, because it says, because the grossness of your iniquity and because of your hostility is so great. So if you just read the first part of that, the prophet is a fool and the inspired man is demented, I would think that what it meant was, you could apply it to today, our preachers are fools. Okay? People who claim to have spiritual insight are demented. But read the whole context, and it says, the prophet is a fool, the inspired man is demented because of the grossness of your iniquity and because of your hostility is so great. So what I think it's really suggesting here is the true man of God and a person who's truly inspired by the Holy Spirit is despised. It's despised. Why? Because of people's iniquity and because they have such hostility towards God. Mm-hmm. It comes out so blatant in everything. And I think that's what it's referring to. You could interpret it by saying the prophet is a fool. You could say the preachers are fools, because we got a lot of them today that are fools, and they're preaching what? They're preaching a foolish message. And the inspired man is demented. Well, people who claim to have a message from God, you could look at what they're saying, and they're crazy. But I really think the context here is that the true people of God are viewed with contempt. And that's what's happening in this society. That's what's happening in our country, isn't it? The people who stand up for righteousness and moral integrity, they are viewed with utter contempt. And then it says here in verse 8, Ephraim was a watchman with my God, a prophet, yet the snare of a bird catcher is in all his ways, and there is only hostility in the house of his God. Okay, Ephraim, in other words, that's interchangeable with Israel. You can say Israel was a watchman with my God. In other words, Israel was appointed by God to be a watchman. To who? To the whole world, to all the nations. And what God wanted his people to do is, hey, I want you out there, and I want you to proclaim what's right, what's wrong, what's good, what's evil, what's clean, what's unclean, what's just, what's unjust. Okay, I want you to be a light unto the nations. I want you to be a beacon to all these surrounding nations. That's what God chose them for. But well, look what they became. You know, it says here, that verse 8, Ephraim was a watchman with my God, a prophet, yet the snare of a bird catcher is in all his ways. In other words, God commissioned him to be a light unto the nations, commissioned Israel to be a light unto the nation. But what happened? You know, she forsook her God, and it says the snare of a bird catcher is in all his ways. The snare of a bird catcher. What's a bird catcher? I mean, a snare of a bird catcher. In other words, he's out for prey. He's out to deceptively capture prey. That's what these people... Look at what this nation is like. We were supposed to be a light unto the world. Let's just say in one area, justice. Look what the lawyers and the judges have done to justice. They have become what? They have become a snare of a bird catcher in all of his ways. In other words, money is far more important than truth. And so they will take the truth, and they will twist it, and they will distort it, they will pervert it, they will deny it, they will torture it to get it to say anything but the truth. Everything is done with an ulterior motive. Mm-hmm. Rather than doing the right thing, saying the right thing, saying what needs to be said, so much of it is just perverted. What does it say here? A snare of a bird catcher is in all his ways, and there is only hostility in the house of his God. And even in the house of God, there's just hostility towards God. I mean, we see this today. You can go to church and you can put on your Sunday best and you can praise God, but what? The hostility is there. All you have to do is look at your life. Is it hostile towards God? Well, then it's hostility towards God. He says here, verse 9, says, they have gone deep into depravity, and as in the days of Gibeah, he will remember their iniquity, he will punish their sins. Now, here's an interesting thing. He says, they have gone deep into depravity. Remember in the book of Romans, it talks about how the truth about God is known to men instinctively because of the things that God has made. And it says that when men turn their back on the truth, okay, then God gives them up to a depraved mind. And they begin to do things that are not natural. And they begin to sin and continue to sin until they begin to fall into deeper and deeper depravity, until they get to the point where they're deep into, sexual perversion. Okay? This is a judgment from God. When you see sexual perversion, it's a judgment from God. It shows that a nation is going deep into depravity. When not only do they go into sexual perversion, but when they legitimize this perversion, when they exalt this perversion, when they promote this perversion, it's not just a matter of tolerating it, it's a matter of promoting it. Well, they're promoting it from kindergarten all the way up in a society. Well, what's interesting is if you read about what it says here, they have gone deep into depravity as in the days of Gibeah. Probably not too many people remember this, but if you go back to the book of Judges, and I believe it was like Judges 18 or something, but don't even turn to Judges 21. I'll just explain the story to you real quick. What happened was there was a Levite. He's from the priestly tribe. He had a concubine that was unfaithful to him. She ran away. She went back to her father's house. Well, this Levite went to his father-in-law's house and says, hey, look, he talked real sweet to his runaway wife and says, hey, man, I'll treat you better. Come on back with me and so on and so forth. Well, his father-in-law was very glad to see his son-in-law come to get, you know, get back his daughter. And so the father-in-law kept imposing upon him, hey, stick around, you know, let's eat, let's have fellowship, you know, and so on and so forth. So the father-in-law delayed him for 3 or 4 days until finally the guy had gotten up and he got a late start. When his father-in-law kept saying, oh, stay another night. I mean, you're getting a late start here. And the guy says, I have to go, man. I have to get going. I got to get back home. So he gets a late start going home. And so on his way home, he can't make it. He can't get home by nightfall. Instead, he gets to Jerusalem. At the time, it wasn't called Jerusalem. This was the day of Judges. This was a city that was inhabited by the Jebusites. And so he gets to Jerusalem, and he thinks to himself, "Man, I can't stay here because you know these people here are not my own people. They're not Israelites." So he goes up to Gibeah, which is about 5 miles north of Jerusalem. Gibeah is an Israelite town. Gibeah is a town or a city in Benjamin, the tribe of Benjamin. So he goes up there thinking, well, now I'm with my own people, you know, and somebody will put me up for the night. So he goes there. He can't find anybody to put him up for the night, even though he had his own food and clothing, everything he needed. Nobody would put him up. So he went to spend the night in the town square. And so he pitches, you know, his tent there to set up in a town square. And then an old man comes in from farming, sees him in the town square, and says, "Man, what are you doing in the middle of the square here?" The guy says, "Well, nobody's taking me in." And he says, "Man, you can't stay here, man. You're in great danger." He says, "Come on home with me." So he goes home to the old man. Gets home. The old man gives him and his wife and his servant. You know, he feeds their donkeys and he takes care of them. And while they're there having dinner, the men of the city of Gibeah, many of the Bible refers to some of the worthless men of Gibeah surround this house. They begin pounding on the door and saying, "Hey, bring that guy out. Bring that new man out. We want to know him sexually." What does that remind you of? Mm-hmm. What happened in Sodom and Gomorrah? The same thing happened there when God overthrew Sodom and Gomorrah. It says all the men of the city surrounded Lot's house and demanded that these men, knew they were angels, but they thought they were men. So here's this guy. You know, the old man goes out the door and says, "Hey, listen, don't do this wickedness, man. Don't do this." He says, "Look, I got a virgin daughter. You can have her, but don't do this wickedness to this man. He's my guest." And so they wouldn't hear it. They said, "We want this guy." So the old man goes back in the house, and here's this guy. He's a real man. Takes his concubine, opens the door, and throws her out. Locks the door. So he's like, he throws this woman, his wife out. This is a concubine. He throws his wife out and says, "Hey, you can have her, but you're not going to touch me." You know, this guy was a real creep to begin with. Okay, but he locks the door to save his own worthless hide. And the men of the city ravage this woman all night long. With all their perversions, they ravage her all night long. And the next day, the guy gets up late in the day, like 11 o'clock or so. He gets out there and he sees this woman laying on the porch, laying in front of the house. And he thinks she's asleep. He gets out there ready to go and says, "Get up, we're going." And get up, and she's dead. These men of the city had killed her. So this Levite takes this woman, puts her on his donkey, goes back home, and what he did was he chopped her into 12 pieces. And he sent, you know, her dismembered body, he sent one part of it to each of the tribes of Israel. Mm-hmm. You know, one tribe would get a hand, another one would get a foot, another one would get a head, another one would get a horse or whatever. And he sent it with a note. This is what the men of Gibeah had done. So all the Israel gets together, and they're really mad, saying, "This something's got to be done here." So the Levite says, "Hey, this is what these people did, and they need to be punished." So the tribes of Israel go before the Lord. They go to the priest, and they say, by casting lots, "Should we go up against Benjamin?" In other words, should we go to war against them because of this wickedness? And God said, "Yeah, go." So you had something like 400,000 men of Israel, and Judah was going to lead the charge, went up to this city. First of all, they went to the city of Gibeah, and they said, "Hey, give us these worthless men. We're going to execute them for this wickedness." And the city wouldn't give up the worthless men, and the tribe of Benjamin wouldn't give them up. They were protecting him. Mm-hmm.
So what happens is that the war broke out on the first day. The Israelites, not the Benjaminites, not the Gibeonites, but the Israelites lost 22,000 men in battle. And they go back to the priest, they go back to the Lord, they say, man, did we misunderstand you? Were we supposed to go up against these people? And the Lord says, yeah, go up against them again. They went up against them again, and the next day they lost 18,000 men. And they thought, man, what's going on here? I mean, these people are wicked people, and they are winning. And so they went back to God again. And God said, go up against them a third time. This time I will give them into your hands. So the next day they go up against the city. And what happens is that they put the whole city in ambush, or surrounded the city where they couldn't be seen. And then a certain number of them went up to the gates, and they started fighting. And so the Benjaminites opened up the gates, and they started pursuing the Israelites. Once they started pursuing them, then all these people in ambush got up, and they ran into the city. They destroyed all the men and the women and the children, and they set the whole place on fire. And then the army was pressed because now, they were out there vulnerable, and they got wiped out. Thousands upon thousands upon thousands upon thousands of them. They reduced the tribe of Benjamin to only 600 men were left by the time this battle was over. They virtually wiped out this whole tribe. And if it wasn't for those 600 men, there wouldn't have been a tribe of Benjamin to be started. But look at what happened here. Look at it, because to me it's a very, very profound example or instruction to us. First of all, God ended up judging all of Israel. Mm-hmm. Because why? This Levite knew, it's obvious he knew that if he just went to each of the tribes and said, look, this is what these wicked people did. Do something about it. They wouldn't have done anything about it. He had to take extreme measures. He had to chop this woman to pieces and send a piece to each one of them to get them to get off the rear end to do the right thing. Mm-hmm. See what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. What's it going to take for America to get off its rear end and do the right thing? What's it going to take some fool down there in Congress, talking about it, debating about it, wondering about it, voting upon it, wondering what to do next? The only way we're going to do the right thing is to really be, motivated. When they got this dismembered body, they were motivated to take care of this evil. Otherwise, they wouldn't have done it. So God basically is saying, hey, because you have let things deteriorate to this point where this guy's got to chop up this woman to get you off your rear end to do the right thing, you're going to be judged too. Mm-hmm. So they were judged. But interesting thing is, none of this would have happened if the men of Benjamin and the men of Gibeah had taken these worthless men and give them over to be executed. So instead, they were virtually wiped out to the man. What does that say about our nation? You see, we are doing everything in our power to protect this perversion, aren't we? And anybody who stands up against it, okay, is going to be shot down. We are not only tolerate this. See, Israel tolerated this wickedness. That's why they were judged. But then Benjamin promoted this wickedness. Gibeah promoted it. Well, this country not only tolerates it, but this country promotes it. This country gets to the point where it protects it. It is legalized. And we are doing more and more and more to, promote this perversion. So what happened to Benjamin? Hey, it's a dark warning to us. What happened to Israel? It's a dark warning to America. That's what he says here. Read it again. He says, they have gone deep into depravity as in the days of Gibeah. He will remember their iniquity. He will punish their sins. Isn't that scary? God will remember our iniquity, how we not only have tolerated this perversion, but we are outright promoting it from kindergarten on up. And God help you if you stand up and say anything against it. And in verse 10 it says, I found Israel like grapes in the wilderness. I saw your forefathers as the earliest fruit on a fig tree in its first season. But they came to Baal Peor and devoted themselves to shame. And they became as detestable as that which they loved. In other words, he says, I found Israel like grapes in the wilderness. I saw your forefathers as the earliest fruits of a fig tree. First of all, he's comparing Israel to the fig tree, right? Mm-hmm. Again, I think you can make that parallel with Jesus says, learn a parable from the fig tree. It stands for Israel. But what God is saying here in this verse, it says, I saw such potential. There was such potential in Israel for good, for greatness, for blessing. I saw such potential in her. That's what he's saying. But what happened? He says, but they came to Baal Peor and devoted themselves to shame. And they became as detestable as the things they love. In other words, Baal Peor, you know, that's where God judged them because they got mixed up with the Moabite women. Okay, and they prostituted themselves. They fell into immorality. And so it was a downhill skid from there. But what God is saying is here, these people had so much potential for goodness and for greatness. But what happened to them? Same thing with us. This country, there's no question about it. We had tremendous potential, and we lived up to the potential until around the 50s or 60s when it all started going in reverse. That was our zenith. And then since from the 60s on, what happens to us? It says they became detestable as that which they loved. Israel became detestable before God because she began to love her sin. Then in verse 11 it says, as for Ephraim, their glory will fly away like a bird. No birth, no pregnancy, no conception. Though they bring up their children, yet I will bereave them until not a man is left. Yes, woe to them. Indeed, I will depart from them. What he's saying here, I think, is very significant. Because as for Ephraim, their glory will fly away like a bird. You wonder, well, who's their glory? What's their glory? You would assume it would be God. But look at the context. The context is their glory is their children. And look at the way it's worded. No birth, no pregnancy, no conception. It almost seems like that should be just the opposite. Yeah, it should be no conception, no pregnancy, no birth.
Yeah.
But it's saying no birth, no pregnancy, no conception. It's going the other way.
Mm-hmm.
And basically, I think what it's saying here is these children are born, but you're going to wish to heck that they never were born because of what's going to happen to them because of you.
Mm.
And that's what's going to happen to people in this country. Their own children are going to have to suffer the consequences for their sinfulness of their parents. And Paul tells us very plainly in Corinthians that, you know, the child is sanctified through the believing parent. All you need is one believing parent where a child is made holy and sanctified before God. Okay, once they reach the age of accountability, then they're on their own as far as God is concerned. But that's what happens. Like, you can't tell me there weren't any infants or children during the Noachian flood, or there weren't any infants or children when Sodom and Gomorrah got destroyed. I don't believe these children went to hell, but unfortunately they suffered the judgment because of their parents. And that's what he's saying here. Because of their parents, their glory, their children are going to fly away as a bird. I mean, they're going to be incarcerated away into captivity, and they're going to be brutally killed. And not only that, it says no birth, no pregnancy, no conception. And they're going to even, you know, kill the children in the womb, which they did. Though they bring up their children, yet I will bereave them until not a man is left. Yes, woe to them indeed, and when I depart from them. He says, when it says when God departs from them, okay, you know, I don't see anything here that would suggest that once you're saved, always saved. It's like Samson. God was with him from conception. He was with him from his birth. And there came a time in his life when after being disobedient towards God, he finally got to the point where it said very plainly that he didn't know that the Spirit of the Lord had left him. And let me ask you something. Has God left America? Well, if we kicked him out of our courts and our schools and everywhere else, I mean, you know, he's not going to force himself upon us. He's gone. I think he's departed. Now, I don't think that he's departed from individuals or from certain fellowships or churches. But as a nation, I don't have any confidence, well, God's here. He's going to protect us. No, I think he's gone, long gone. Why? Because we threw him out. He's not going to beg and plead. He says, you don't want me? I'm out of here. And verse 13, Ephraim, I have seen, is planted in a pleasant meadow like Tyre, but Ephraim will bring out his children for slaughter. You know, you can almost change that around. America, I have seen, is planted as a pleasant meadow like Tyre. In other words, Tyre was a seaport city that was very, very wealthy. It was very, I mean, it was a beautiful, beautiful place. Well, you know, we have our own hymn, America the Beautiful, shining from sea to sea, you know, Purple Mountains Majesty. God has blessed this nation more than any nation on earth. And it's going to go up in smoke. He says, but Ephraim will bring out his children for slaughter. In spite of all that they had going for them, this is going to be the end result. In verse 14, give them, O Lord, what wilt thou give? Give them a miscarrying womb and a dry breast. This is Hosea praying. Look what he's praying for. He's praying, give them, O Lord, what wilt thou give? Give them a miscarrying womb and a dry breast. In other words, he's praying that they don't have kids because he's concerned that they're for the judgments that are coming upon Israel. He's concerned for the welfare of the little children that are going to be, you know, caught up in this judgment. That's why he's praying. Isn't that what Jesus said about Israel when at the midway point of the tribulation period? He says, pray that this day where the abomination of desolation takes place does not happen on a Sabbath, or that you are not nursing a child at the breast, or that you're not pregnant. Because it, you know, it's going to be a severe time, and it's going to have a tremendous hardship upon children. And he says in verse 15, all their evil is at Gilgal. Indeed, I came to hate them there because of the wickedness of their deeds. I will drive them out of my house. I will love them no more. All their princesses are rebels. Ephraim is stricken. Their root is dried up. They will bear no fruit. Even though they bear children, I will slay the precious ones of their womb. My God will cast them away because they have not listened to him, and they will be wanderers among the nations. He says this in verse 15, all their evil is at Gilgal. Indeed, I came to hate them there. Because of the wickedness of their deeds, I will drive them out. Now, Gilgal, if you know, first of all, if you read in other portions of the scripture, Gilgal was a place where they ended up worshiping all these false idols. But what happened in Gilgal was it's just a city a little north of Jerusalem. What happened there was that I don't have time to get into it, but if you go back to the First Samuel, you'll read that the people got disenchanted with Samuel's sons. They were judges. Mm-hmm. And so they went to Samuel and said, hey, we want a king. We want you to anoint us a king. Okay? Because we want to be like all the other nations, and we will have a king that he will go out and fight our battles for. And Samuel was really dismayed by that. And he went to God and says, man, these people are asking for a king, man. And God says, hey, they haven't insulted you. They haven't rejected you. They've rejected me. Mm-hmm. He says, I'll tell you what, you give them their king. He says, hey, but this will be the procedure of the king. You know, he will take a tenth of your crop and a tenth of this and a tenth of that and a tenth of this and a tenth of that. He will take this, that, and the other thing. And says, until the day they cry out to me, and I won't listen to them. We are taxed to the point where 50% of our income is going to the government. These guys are crying because they had 10% taken away. Okay? But he said, I won't listen to them. Anyway, I'm getting off on a tangent here. All I'm saying here is that God said this. You want a king? I'll give you a king. But God was rejected by them. In other words, they didn't look to God as being their king. So he gave them Saul. He anointed Saul. And Saul was anointed at Gilgal. He gave them what they wanted. They wanted a king. And so that's where God began to hate them. In other words, what's happening to us is this. Instead of the word king, put the word government. Everywhere, every place in this country where government is taking the place of God, you will find that this is where so much of our problems have originated or continue to perpetuate. The government is taking the place of God. I just don't have the time to go into this litany of how. We got this whole cockamamie notion of separation of church and state. Well, what's happened is that God's being run out on a rail and the state is taking over and everything. And that's where God has come to hate us, just like it says in Gilgal. I will drive them out of my house. I will love them no more. All their princesses are rebels. All their politicians are rebels. You find me one person in the Democratic Party who's not a rebel before God. To me, it's a contradiction of terms to have somebody in that party who is truly committed to God. How can that possibly be when everything they stand for is hostile towards God? And then you can only find about a handful of Republicans who are serious about God. And okay, we're closing this down. And it says in 16, it says, Ephraim is stricken, the root is dried up, they will bear no fruit, even though they bear children. I will slay the precious ones of their womb. My God will cast them away because they have not listened to him, and they will be wanderers among the nations. Well, we know that all that has been fulfilled. Oh, man, I didn't realize it was so late. Sorry about that, guys.
Well, when you said that, we all knew you couldn't do it in 20 minutes.
Well, sorry, guys. Well, can I say this? We got started half an hour late, so we're actually ending 10 minutes early. So, hey, I'm sorry, but I didn't.
I can't say that.
Okay, does anybody have anything you want to add or share?